Hi, I'm Gary from Stonyfield, the organic yogurt company, a proud supporter of Living on Earth. The President's Cancer Panel recommends eating foods produced without toxic, persistent pesticides and chemical fertilizers. We couldn't agree more, and that's why we make organic yogurt, because you can trust that harmful chemicals are never used in organic food production.
The atomic age began July 16, 1945. The first nuclear device that was detonated was nicknamed the Gadget.
Three different cameras recorded from 6 miles away.
Over the next half century, the United States produced 60,000 nuclear weapons. At the heart of each device, plutonium, difficult to make, even harder to clean up. Most of the nation's supply of plutonium was produced in reactors in south central Washington state at a restricted site known as Hanford, a 580-square-mile complex along the Columbia River. The production of plutonium at Hanford ended in 1989, and the massive task of cleaning up decades of radioactive pollution began. This upbeat but accurate video was produced by the Department of Energy, which is in charge of the Hanford cleanup.
The sheer magnitude of the impact on the environment is staggering, resulting in nearly incomprehensible numbers. Numbers like 270 billion gallons of contaminated groundwater and 53 million gallons of waste in 177 underground storage tanks. This waste is the legacy of more than five decades of plutonium production, making it easy to see how Hanford became the largest, most complex environmental cleanup effort in the world.
And costly. Over the years, the cost to clean up Hanford has tripled to more than $12 billion. It was supposed to be completed last year, but that didn't happen. And some doubt that the project to deal with the deadly plutonium ever will be successfully finished. Peter Eisler is an investigative reporter with USA Today. In his recent story, Cleaning Up a Cold War Mess, Eisler details the daunting technical challenges that are boosting costs and slowing progress at the Hanford weapons site.
The government went in the early 40s and secretly bought up a lot of this property. They needed an out-of-the-way place with a water supply and somewhere where no one would notice the development of a massive top-secret manufacturing operation. On one end of it, they have the reactors where they produce plutonium for the nuclear weapons production facility. And then over towards the other side of the site, they have this enormous plant that they're building to clean up all the waste from that. The waste is confined to an area where they had what they call tank farms, about 177 underground tanks, and there's been a good deal of leakage in and around those tanks. About 1 million gallons of waste has escaped.
These tanks contain something like 53, 55 million gallons of high-level radioactive waste.
The latest estimate is 56 million gallons of high-level waste, yeah.
What happened to the stuff that leaked?
There is an environmental cleanup going on there. It's in the ground. Some of it is in the groundwater. The fear is that that waste could migrate to the Columbia River, which is nearby, which borders one side of the site, and contaminate the aquifer there. And that provides drinking water to millions of people stretching all the way down to Portland, Oregon.
Now, the plan is to take the liquid waste in these underground tanks and pump it into a new facility, what they call, I guess, the pretreatment facility, a vast, vast, vast building.
Right. The pretreatment facility is one of four giant buildings at this new treatment plant that they're building. The treatment plant is actually a 65-acre complex, and there are these four buildings. And the first building that the waste goes into is the pretreatment building, and that is the most complicated part of the operation and the part where they're running into the most problems.
Your article in USA Today has a video that accompanies it, and I want to play a clip from that. You interviewed a woman named Donna Bushy.
Yes, Donna is the site safety manager for the prime subcontractor at the site. So she is in charge of making sure that all of the systems that are installed meet the safety requirements that have been set.
If controls are not properly installed in the design, hydrogen can detonate or explode in a pipe or in a vessel and release large quantities of radioactive material.
That's pretty dramatic.
Well, that's one of the big concerns that they're facing here. When you're handling this kind of material, you really have to plan for the worst case scenario and be prepared for the worst case scenario. And hydrogen gas buildup is an inherent problem when you're treating this waste because the radioactive material reacts with water and splits the hydrogen and oxygen molecules, and it creates hydrogen gas that bubbles up, and it can get trapped in pipes, and it can get trapped in the tops of these big vessels that they use to hold the waste. And if too much hydrogen gets trapped in those spaces, then you can have a combustible situation, and that would be a very big problem.
So the plan is to take this waste and turn it into glass, right? These huge glass rods.
Yep. Ultimately, this is a process called vitrification, and it's been done before on a much, much smaller scale with much less complex waste. And what they do is they essentially blend the waste with glass-forming particles in a molten mixture, and it makes a liquid glass that they pour into these giant steel canisters. And the glass cools and solidifies in these canisters, and what you end up with at the end of 30 years of processing is tens of thousands of steel canisters with glass rods inside.
So this waste treatment and immobilization plant that they're building, they're designing it as they're constructing it?
Yes, it's what they call a design-build project, and that has a lot of people very concerned. It is one of the biggest technical challenges that they're facing.
In your video, you have one of the senior engineers from the Department of Energy, Don Alexander, and he's very skeptical of this plan.
So on the one hand, while the issues are being discussed over here on the side, the project's going full steam ahead, and it's getting us deeper and deeper in trouble.
That's from the Department of Energy scientist.
Their concern is that there is such a push to finish this project, there's a lot of time pressure to get it done, that they're moving ahead with these designs without validating them, without testing them sufficiently to be sure that they'll work. Once the plant begins operating, this material is so radioactive that much of the plant is sealed off. The moment they start processing it, they essentially weld the doors shut, and it's got to run for at least 30 years to do its job. So if there is a problem, a significant problem with a piece of equipment in one of these areas, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to go in and fix it, and it could leave you with a plant that doesn't work.
I understand they call these areas black cells.
Yep, they're black cells, and to sort of imagine the technical challenge, think about building a car where you welded the hood shut and expected that car to run for 100,000 miles and could never get in and touch the engine. That's essentially what you're talking about with black cells.
What happens if you have one of these sealed areas, these black cells, and it doesn't work as advertised? Something does go wrong. What happens?
Well, that's the $12 billion question. You know, they have some robotic options for trying to go in and deal with certain kinds of problems, but a major problem would force them to have to abandon the process in that area.
And then what happens to the waste?
Well, then the waste is still there, and that's the scenario that nobody wants to contemplate, is investing all of this money and all this effort and all this time to build this plant and then having it not be able to complete its job. And if you're still left with all this liquid waste in these very old, deteriorating underground tanks, then you're right back to where we are now with the threat of an environmental disaster.
What does Bechtel National say? They're the prime contractor.
They are, and they say that they will not put cost and schedule ahead of safety and operational success.
I guess that's what the Department of Energy is saying. You also interviewed Dale Knutson. He's the project director for the Department of Energy.
As we learn things, we'll adjust. As the technical issues provide new surprises to us, we'll adjust. And as we bring the design to completion, we'll ensure that the design has been validated against the safety criteria, and that we never allow the plant to be operated in a mode that doesn't satisfy the safety requirements that we began with our baseline.
That is certainly the Energy Department's position, and the question now is, okay, if you're going to go out and do more testing, and you've already built some of this stuff, are you really going to be willing to go back in and tear it out and redo it if the tests prove not to be successful?
So this thing is supposed to be up and running in, what, 2019 now, right?
That is the legal deadline for getting, for what they call a hot start, for getting it up and running, yes.
So let's say it does go online in 2019, and they have this vitrified plutonium, the glass enclosed in these steel coffins. What happens then? What do they do with all of those coffins?
Well, that's another unanswered question. Originally, they had planned to put those coffins at Yucca Mountain, where they were building a repository for nuclear waste, also for from all of the commercial nuclear power plants around the country. Now that that project is not moving forward, there is no immediate plan for what to do with these tens of thousands of finished cylinders. And mind you, these cylinders remain enormously radioactive in some cases, depending on which kinds of waste has been vitrified in the glass, to the point where, you know, a human being couldn't even go near them. So they're going to have to build some sort of special on-site storage facility to hold these things until a permanent repository is built.
Peter Eisler is an investigative reporter with USA Today. A link to his story, Cleaning Up a Cold War Mess, and a lot more can be found on our website, loe.org. Coming up, finding new timber to preserve the sonic timber for fine guitars. Stay tuned to Living on Earth.
Support for Living on Earth comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration in solving the world's most pressing environmental problems. The Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation and Gilman Ordway for coverage of conservation and environmental change. This is Living on Earth on PRI, Public Radio International.